If you recall, the last time we met, which was 2 weeks ago, we finished up chapter 9, and there we were talking about the Gibeonites and the fact that they had come to Joshua and they had tricked Joshua, pretending to be something else, and then they ended up, signing this, entering into this treaty with Joshua and the nation of Israel. Albeit under false pretenses, but it was clear that this treaty would hold and it would bind both sides. So what we're going to see here in chapter 10 is actually an immediate response to that treaty plus what happened before then. Okay, so we will start chapter 10, verse 1. When Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, learned that Joshua had captured the Ai, and prescribed it, treating Ai and its king as he had treated Jericho and its king, and that moreover, the people of Gibeon had come to terms with Israel and entered into a treaty with Israel, and remained among them, he was very frightened, for Gibeon was a large city, like one of the royal cities, in fact, larger than Ai, and all its men were warriors. Okay, so this lays the background, lays the scene for us. What is really going on? So we learn, first of all, we see that there's an initiative being taken by Adonizedek. Adonizedek. Now I'm not sure, how do you pronounce that in English? Is that Adonizedek?
Adonizedek, I think.
That's good. All right. Now.
Yeah, I think Adonizedek is what. Okay. We read it.
Adonizedek. Okay. So Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem. Now, you may recall that there was once another king of Jerusalem with a very similar name. Can you remember it? Well, you may have a harder time remembering it because in English you say it a little funny.
Okay. Melchizedek.
Melchizedek. Exactly. Melchizedek. Yeah. But in Hebrew, listen to the way I'm saying it. It's Melchizedek. And Adoni Tzedek. The word Tzedek is very clear in both of them. Not only that, each of these names have meanings. Melchizedek or Melchizedek means my king is Tzedek. Adoni Tzedek means my lord is Tzedek. Very similar. Okay, they're just using different terms to refer to their leader, a king or a lord. Okay. Tzedek, what does tzedek mean? Well, in Hebrew, tzedek means justice or righteousness, okay? Tzedek is it's righteousness, but usually in the context of a legal context. In other words, you are going to be looking for justice or righteousness. You want the right thing to be done. You will go to court. You want to make sure that justice is done. This is usually the meaning of tzedek. So what we see here is somebody who's the king of Jerusalem, and he's taking the initiative. Now, this is not a good initiative, by the way. The initiative is to put together a coalition of the southern nations, the southern Canaanite nations, to come together and fight against Joshua and Israel. So that's certainly not a good thing, but I just thought I wanted to just spend a few minutes trying to analyze this tzedek. What is the connection? Clearly, and when we saw this before, for example, Egypt. Kings of Egypt are called Pharaoh. Kings of the Philistines, certainly in Abraham's time, are called Avimelech. So we're seeing that very often kings of a particular nation or area will have certain names that will be not their private names, but will be their regal names, okay? And so it seems to be that in the case of Jerusalem, the kings have the name Tzedek somehow worked into their name. So what exactly does that mean? What is the significance? Now, I read somewhere Tzedek in modern Hebrew, actually not so modern Hebrew, also in fairly ancient Hebrew, post-biblical, but in ancient Hebrew, Tzedek is the Hebrew word for the planet Jupiter. So there is someone who made a connection and says as follows. The same planet was called Tzedek in Hebrew, Jupiter in Greek or whatever, and Baal in, Mesopotamian, Aramean, or whatever was these Middle Eastern languages. Okay, now we know what Baal is. Baal ends up being a very popular god, pagan god, of course, that we meet extensively in later books. Okay, we meet him in the book of Judges, and he shows up in a few other places. So certainly very extensively in 2 Kings. Ahab, Baal is a huge player there. So the theory is that these, when they talk about my king Tzedek or my lord Tzedek, they are referring to a pagan belief in this god, alternatively referred to as Baal, Jupiter, or Tzedek. That's possible, okay? But the reason I have trouble with that is because the first Tzedek king that we meet, Malki Tzedek, is not a pagan, okay? He comes out to Abraham and he blesses him in the name of the one God. And so that is why I have trouble seeing that. On the other hand, I note that in Isaiah, of course, which is a much later book, but in Isaiah chapter 1, let me just find it here. Isaiah chapter 1, of course, Isaiah is talking about Jerusalem there, and he's mourning Jerusalem and mourning what has happened to Jerusalem. In verse 21, alas, she has become a harlot. Talking about Jerusalem, the faithful city that was filled with law and where justice dwelt. Okay, and here we have two words. Mishpat is law, and tzedek is the same word. Tzedek we have here is justice. So as I mentioned before, tzedek or justice is very often, or righteousness, depending on how you want to translate it, is usually in context of law or in justice being done within the context of law. So here we see Jerusalem is identified as a city of law, a city of justice. And so I wonder if perhaps this idea wasn't something that Jerusalem was known for, whether the kings were good kings or bad kings. Perhaps Jerusalem filled a certain function as a center of justice, as a place where people went to get their day in court, or as a city that was known for a city that cared about doing right by its citizens, having a legal system, a place where people could address their grievances and there would be judgment there. You know, I'm talking about civil judgment here. And it could be that that was what Jerusalem was. And I think then that makes a lot of sense if we see that it's the king of Jerusalem who takes the initiative, because a city that would have been seen as a center of justice probably would have been a central city in the land of Canaan. And therefore it makes sense that the king of that city would be the one who takes the initiative and gathers around him the kings of the neighboring cities in the southern part of the land of Canaan. And I think it makes, you know, if you think about it today, it's almost a mantra when we hear in Israel talk about Jerusalem, and we talk about it as being the eternal capital of Israel. And I think what I'm seeing here, and I'm questioning, because this is just my thoughts on the issue. I mean, I can't prove any of this, but I'm wondering if Jerusalem didn't already serve, even though in the time of Joshua, we'll learn later on, there's actually a list of 31 different kings that he defeats and 31 different cities. So in that time, each city is almost a country in its own right with its own king. And yet it's very possible that Jerusalem was a sort of center, a sort of capital, if you will, not capital in the way we know it in modern ways, but some kind of a center. And therefore, it's very possible that Jerusalem was the capital of Israel even before King David, okay? Even before King David. And that it could be that it has this natural tendency, this something that from its very beginnings as a city, it was already a place where people's eyes focused on and went to seek justice. It went to seek righteousness. And that's, of course, what we, you know, how we see Jerusalem today and how we've seen it, you know, throughout our Jewish tradition since King David's time. Okay, so that's just a little comment on that. Now let's get into the actual story. Okay, so we see what we're seeing here also is that he's Adoni Tzedek is worried. He's frightened, makes it very clear. He's frightened because, and that we see in verse 2, he's very frightened. Why? First of all, he sees what how Joshua has already defeated Jericho and what he did to the king. Do we know anything about what we did to the what Joshua did to the king of Jericho or what he did to the king of Ai? What we know here is that whatever he did to one, he did the same thing to the other. So if you look at chapter 8, first of all, in chapter 8, verse 2, we have the same thing. And God's promise to Joshua, he says, "Behold, I have given in your hand the king of the Ai and his nation, and his city and his land, and you will do to the Ai and his king exactly as you have done to Jericho and his king." Okay, and then we learn at the end of chapter 8 in verse 28 and 29, Joshua burned the Ai and turned it into an everlasting hill of desolation to this very day. Okay, and pay attention to 29, and the king of the Ai, he hung on a tree until the evening. And when the sun set, Joshua commanded to take down his body from the tree. Okay, so first of all, we don't know what happened to the king of Jericho, except from this our verse here in chapter 10, we know that whatever happened to the king of Ai also happened to the king of Jericho. So here we learn that both of them were hung on a tree. And I will note that Joshua commands to take them off the tree at the end of the day. They don't leave them up on that tree for days, okay? They're on the tree or scaffold or whatever. They're on that hanging just for the day, and then when nightfall comes. And I will remind you, one of the things that we discussed last week when we were talking, or 2 weeks ago, when we were talking about the Gibeonites and we were talking about the breaking of the treaty that was made between Joshua and the Gibeonites, and about how at the end of that story, we have that horrible story of the children of Saul that are not only killed, but left out and not buried. And that is being the opposite of the way one is supposed to treat a dead body, which we know from scripture, not to leave it overnight. So here you have a situation that Joshua, even though he was killing his enemy, he still treated them with respect. He hung them on the tree. But then before nighttime, he treated them with the same respect that we have in scripture about not leaving a dead body hanging, because that is seen as a desecration of God's name. Any human being dead hanging out there is seen as a desecration of God's name. Okay, so that's just that little detail about that. Now, what happens next? He gathers together. Oh, and another thing I just want to point out. Not just is this king frightened because of the victories that take place in Jericho and the Ai, but also the fact that Gibeon has entered into a treaty, because effectively Gibeon has surrendered before the first shot was fired. And he's saying, what is Gibeon? Gibeon is a huge city. It's a fortified city with very powerful and strong soldiers. Okay. So if they already are surrendering before they even enter a war, he's it just makes him that much more frightened of what this nation of Israel is posing to him, the type of threat that he poses. Now, again, like we talked about previously, when we saw these kind of responses in the kings of Canaan for Jericho and the Ai, they have actually they are observing a situation. They are correctly surmising that Israel, with God behind them, is a very powerful enemy. They have two choices. They can do what Gibeon does. They can say, all right, that's it. Give up. Surrender. It's just, there's no hope here. Or they can do what Adoni Tzedek does and says, okay, maybe Jericho and Ai and Gibeon, each what happened to them, what happened, because they each acted on their own. And no one city can succeed opposite this nation of Israel. However, perhaps if all of us get together and we create a coalition and we create a huge armed force, then we can prevail. So, of course, he makes the wrong choice, because if he understood that it's God behind Israel and it doesn't matter how many soldiers you're going to put up against him, God is going to prevail. Of course, if he had realized that, or if he had taken the time to try to, you know, put aside his arrogance a little bit and realize this, then the story would have ended very differently. But that's not what happens. And so he sent to all these different cities and to the kings, and he says, let's go together. And what is his plan? Plan is actually very, very clever. Okay. He's going to attack what he sees as the weak link in this whole situation. Okay. What's the weak link? Gibeon. Gibeon is not an Israelite. Gibeon has just yesterday signed this treaty in a fraudulent way, actually. Okay. Under false pretenses, has signed a treaty with Joshua, and he is kind of basically forced out of Joshua's commitment to come to their defense. Okay. So he's probably saying, okay, let's go attack Gibeon. Let's see. First of all, I think he probably doesn't believe that Joshua is going to bother coming to the defense of a Gibeon. Okay. Gibeon, which is, you know, as we said, it's not one of them. It's just someone that they just signed a treaty with. They don't have a relationship with him, and he's going to do this. But what is Joshua's response? So they do. They go up and they go fight. They go attack Gibeon. And Gibeon, what does Gibeon do? Immediately sends word to Joshua. We are being attacked. We signed a treaty. Please come and help us. And Joshua does not even hesitate. Okay. He goes up from the Gilgal after what happened with Gibeon. They go back to the Gilgal. The Gilgal is down by the Jordan River. Okay, that's the Dead Sea. Okay, now you see two, basically you're seeing here the red lines. It's the red lines I want to start with. So Kim, go up. No, go back to the Dead Sea. Go straight up to the beginning of the first red line, right there. That's the Gilgal. And you can see the blue line to the right of the Gilgal, that's the Jordan River. Okay, so you see the beginning of the red line is the Gilgal. That's where they're camped. The second note on that red line is Jericho. They go up from the Jordan Valley and they take Jericho, okay? Now, follow the red line along, okay? And then you go up, not here to the one up after it, go further up. That is the Ai, okay? Now, further to the west, the top line there is Bethel, not that one, right above it, Bethel, okay? Just to give you a sense of those of you who have ever been in this area, go back to the Ai, just to the right of you there, right? Okay. That red line over here follows more or less Route 60 of today. Okay. Straight up above is Ophrah. Then there's the Ai, and you come down. And if you go all the way down below the red line, go all the way down to the end, the beginning of the next red line, down, 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 down. That's Jerusalem. Jerusalem. Okay, so basically, if you're thinking about how to get to Jerusalem today, Route 60, you go to the top of that red line we were before, just go straight down and you get to Jerusalem. Okay, no, not that line, the other one. Okay, fine. Now, so they've already conquered Jericho. Okay, they conquered the Ai. So this whole eastern area on along this red route, they have taken care of. Okay, that's it. That's Gibeon. Okay. Yeah. So what you see is Gibeon is in a very important area. It's a big city in the middle of this area, brings us further west, okay? And it's more or less midway between Jerusalem, which is at the bottom, and these mountains of Samaria, which is up on top. And don't forget, we're in Shechem. We already did the Treaty of Shechem, which is off the map, but further north, okay? So this area here across is very significant. The fact that Gibeon surrendered means that this entire area here north of Jerusalem is now more or less under control of the Israelites. Okay, now, and we see where Jerusalem is down below. That's Adoni Tzedek. So Adoni Tzedek sees this massive army has already controlled most of the area to the north of him, and he's saying, okay, let's see if we can prevent them from coming south. And so Jerusalem here, he connects, and he connects with Hebron, which is further south. We don't have these on the map, but you just have all these other places that are further down on the map. And this is where we're going to do. So just to picture, you know, what it is we're talking about. Okay, now we can take off the map now. I don't think we just wanted to give you a sense of that. Okay, good. Okay, so they go and they fight again. They fight against. In verse 8, God said, promises Joshua, "Don't worry. You know that you will be successful." And in fact, we see in verse 10 that they managed to, you know, defeat these nations at Gibeon. And it says then, they chased them by a Beit Horon to Azekah and to Makkedah. These are places further south. They're south and west of Jerusalem, okay? So basically, you have this center city that I showed you, Gibeon. That's where they defeat them. But then, as these kings and their armies are running back south to where they came from, Joshua is going to continue chasing them because this is going to become his opportunity to conquer the whole south of the country. Once he defeats this coalition of the southern kings, the south of the country is his, finished, done, okay? And that's basically what happens. Now, we have a number of, one of the things that is so interesting about this chapter, if you compare this chapter to, let's say, the Battle of Jericho, Battle of Jericho was a completely miraculous war. They had to do very little. Okay, the walls came crumbling down. They came in after it. But the focus of the story is the trumpets and the prayers and the surrounding the city, and the walls came tumbling down. Ai was a war that really was a very natural war. One of the problems that the Israelites had in waging that war is they didn't make any plans. They didn't plan strategies because they assumed that the walls would come tumbling down, similar to Jericho. But no, God wanted the nation to do something in the eye, to make a plan, to fight a war. And of course, it took this only the second time where they figured that out and they did it right. Now, there's no question as they're fighting, they need to realize that God is helping them out, but it doesn't mean they can just sit by and assume that miracles are going to happen. In this case, we have number one, God saying to Joshua, you know, don't worry because I'm going to put them in your hands. But at the same time, he is definitely fighting a battle. It says he came up from the Gilgal at night. So he's clearly looking to surprise them at dawn. And then not only does he defeat them, but he chases after them. But we do see in the context of this war that there are some very interesting miracles. There's one miracle right away, and that we see in verse 11, as he's chasing them, okay? Suddenly God throws these major boulders from the skies on the army, okay? So it says, it calls these like hailstones, but like we talk about hailstones, we talk about snow, but these seem to have been extremely big and unusual and hard and whatever, lethal, these lethal things that were coming down from the heavens. And it says here that more people ended up dying because of these stones or hailstones or whatever coming from the skies than those that were actually killed by the soldiers of Israel. So that already says something. You know, there is this sense of side-by-side battling, okay? Side-by-side, you know, that's it's interesting. Side-by-side, I mean, God and Israel together. Okay, they're in this battle together. We have God throwing down the stones and we have the Israelites with their sword. And this seems to be the winning combination where the Israelites need to understand that they have to really fight. This is a real battle. We need soldiers. But on the other hand, God is going to be doing this with them alongside them. And they understand that. And they of course, this part of their whole, not part of their plan, but part of what has become their reality. And it's just wonderful. Okay, then we have an amazing miracle. Okay, and it's a miracle that actually has gotten a lot of, in the Middle Ages, caused tremendous problems for this fellow named Galileo. Okay, Joshua gets up there and he says, he calls, he needs, he's already fighting them, he's already chased them halfway down, but he wants to finish the job. He wants to make sure he has enough daylight hours so that he continue driving them as far south as possible and really defeating them, okay? And so he says, he calls out and he says, look, turning, you know, he says, sun, stay still in Gibeon, moon, stay still in the Ayalon Valley, okay? So we know where Gibeon was just to the north of where he is, and the Ayalon Valley is to the south. So basically, or you could say east and west a little bit, but basically what he wanted to do is freeze the daylight so that he could have more hours of daylight. Now, first of all, why did Galileo get in trouble here? Because this indicates that it's the sun and the moon that are moving in a way, right? And so what did Joshua said, sun and moon stop moving. Now, what happened in the Middle Ages? Suddenly scientists understood that it's not the sun and the moon that moves and the earth is not flat. The earth is round. It's the earth that travels around on its axis in a 24-hour cycle. And therefore, it hits the sun and moon at different times, but it's the earth that moves, not the sun. And this created a lot of crises for Christians. That didn't create a crisis for Jews, I don't think, but it created a crisis for Christians who took this all extremely literally and said, oh no. Therefore, anybody who says the earth is not flat, but is round, and it is the earth that moves, it, not the sun, the moon, is a heretic, because look what we have here. We have Joshua saying that it's the sun and the moon that's going to stay still. So poor Galileo. What exactly is the solution to this? And I think that, and I don't even see that this is an issue in the Jewish commentaries in the Middle Ages and since, because what they basically are saying is Joshua is making this call. Joshua is reading the information as he sees it. All of us, and I would venture to say every one of us as children, when we saw the sun rise in the morning and move over and sink in the west, all of us had this picture of a flat earth and a sun rising in the east and setting in the west. And it looked to all of us as if that's the sun was moving, not the earth. And there's no question that the Bible is written for people to understand, for people to understand when it was written all the way to today. And if we keep that in mind, that we realize that this does describe how we as human beings, certainly human beings before we had the scientific knowledge that we have today, this is how we would have seen it. If the day would have suddenly been frozen in time, we would have seen a sun not move. Would we have realized that actually it's the earth not moving, so it looks like the sun, you know, isn't moving? But whatever it was, this is how it would look to us. And this, by the way, is an important understanding that applies in different places as well. When we see certain things written in the Bible and we wonder, wait, but that does that really jive with what we know is happening scientifically? But it does jive with how we would see it, or how people at this time would have perceived it. And we have a phrase in Judaism that says, the Bible has spoken in the language of human beings. And if you think about it for a moment, the whole concept of God speaking to human beings, okay? What language does God speak? How does God put his thoughts and stuff? You know, we have a book that's written at black and white, words on a page, written down, okay? It's also expressing to us very, very deep concepts. Now, it's one thing when it's telling a story, but there's also all kinds of other things. We go back and we think about creation. If we think about the concept of prophecy, if we think about the concept of God appearing to human beings, all of these things are, if you step back for a second and realize these are very complicated subjects. Do we really understand what they are to the fullest? Impossible, because God is so way beyond our human capability of understanding. And so what God has done is written a book that we can understand. This is, does not limit God. It is reflecting our limitations. And I think that's part of what's going on here. The sun stood still. No, we have since learned, thank God, science has developed. The sun doesn't stand still. The earth stood still. But this is how we would understand it. This is how we would perceive it. And particularly people back then in biblical times who had no idea that the earth was round and that the earth was moving on its own axis. This is how it would have been perceived. This is where we're going to stop today. We are going to take up next week with this whole idea, because there's much greater issues having to do with this miracle. Okay, how did it happen? What does it mean? Did all of the planets, you know, get out of whack? You know, these are questions that have been raised, and we certainly want to address those next week. And of course, we will then continue with the rest of the chapter and how this war pans out. So that's all for today. Any comments or questions?
Sandra, I was just thinking about Jerusalem and how the Bible says that deliverance will come out of Zion. And I think that Jerusalem was chosen by God for his purpose to reveal himself through that city. And so it started out with someone like Melchizedek speaking to Abraham, and it and then declined to a place where this king that we're reading about, king of the Canaanites, but this isn't the final story as we know.
Right. No, but that's great. I think I like what you said. It reinforces this idea that Jerusalem from the beginning of time had a special focus, a special role. Yeah. Hmm. Anyone else? Okay, well, great to see you all this week, and I will look forward to seeing you next week, and hopefully we won't have any interruptions for quite some time. Stay healthy, everybody.
Yeah, thanks COVID very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Sandra.
I hope you enjoyed that video, and we'd like to be sure you're getting all of our video content, so just click on the subscribe button below, as well as on the notification bell. And that way you will have easy access to all our material. We look forward to staying in touch with you. God bless you and have a wonderful day.